Undisciplined is a collaboration between African and African-American studies at the University of Arkansas and KUAF.
The podcast provides a peek into the complex issues that affects our interconnected world.
Taking the interdisciplinary approach of African and African-American studies to the classroom, into the community, onto the airwaves, and beyond. I am your host, Dr. Karee Banton, and for this sixth season, I have a new co-host,
Carrie Nisia Connor.
Let's get into it. Good morning, listeners. We're recording at morning time. Welcome back to another episode.
Welcome.
Hope you've enjoyed our other episodes this season as we've looked at various facets of history and education. We've met with a wide array of people, from students to scholars to activists and, you know, different individuals exploring different facets of history. And today we are joined again by another guest who is doing very important work in this field as well. And we're just so thrilled to have her, a daughter of Fayetteville, Arkansas. Daughter of Fayetteville, Arkansas, also went to Fayetteville High, who is currently a professor at UNC. You know, we are so thrilled to have Dr. Duvall here with us. Dr. Kathleen Duvall, as I mentioned, is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her expertise is early American history, particularly interactions of Native Americans, Europeans, and Africans on the borderlands of North America. What is undisciplined about this for us that we want you to take a note of today is that she has written a number of different books, Independence Lost, Lives on the Edge of the American Revolution. She also has a forthcoming book, Native Nations, A Millennium in North America. But she recently released a textbook. I have here, let me see, the seventh volume. Give Me Liberty, an American History, that she wrote in collaboration with the great Eric Foner and Lisa McGuire. So we are so thrilled to have her today, especially talking about a textbook.
Yeah.
And what that means for teaching American history, writing a formative text and collaborating with other great minds on and deciding what goes into that text and what our students should be learning about American history. So Dr. Duvall, please welcome to Undisciplined.
Yes. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be talking with you all and a pleasure to be coming back to Fayetteville for a visit too.
I'm really glad you're here because, you know, every one of us has been disciplined by the choices of textbooks that have been in our classrooms throughout the nation, right? Like, and so I like that in this episode, we're getting undisciplined to kind of understand what are the ways in which this textbook has done things differently. And what do we need in textbooks? I think this is an important question to consider. You know, all of us in some, you know what, in some classrooms, teachers don't even have textbooks right now, you know? So that's a real reality. And so, like, you know, one, if they don't have textbooks, how do we get materials to them that are going to be relevant to our students' learning, that tells the truth, but not just the facts of history, but the truth of it? And so I'm really glad that you're here to kind of help us to think through textbooks, production of textbooks, and the choices that you make when making a textbook.
Right.
Wonderful. Yeah. So Dr. Duvall, by way of starting, can you tell us, how did you come to be interested in the area that you studied?
Mm-hmm. Well, it actually, you know, it started in Arkansas. I left Arkansas. I went to college in California, went to grad school in California, and I knew I wanted to study early American history. And the reason I wanted to study early American history was I was fascinated by how very different kinds of people sort of collided in early America, some by choice and many not by choice. and how they made sense of that, how they created the world that became the United States and became the world that we know. And so in graduate school, I was sort of fishing around for a topic where I might be able to study those things. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll look at whatever was going on in Arkansas back in the 1700s. I knew there had been French and Spanish colonization here. And I thought, well, I can read a little French, I can read a little Spanish. So I started looking around for documents, as historians do, of course. And it turned out there were tons and tons of documents written by the French and the Spanish in Arkansas. And when I started reading them, almost all they talked about were the Native nations in the region, the Quapaws and the Osage. And it just slowly dawned on me, much more slowly than it should have, that these were maybe 5 to 10 French guys, 5 to 10 Spanish guys at a time out there, you know, at Arkansas Post on the Arkansas River, surrounded by tens of thousands of Quapaws and Osage. And of course, that's what they mostly wrote about in those years, you know, the years of the 1700s. Was what Native nations wanted. And so I knew that Native American history would be part of what I studied, but it became a much larger part than I thought it would be at first, just because those voices and those experiences of 18th century Native Americans just were all over the documents, which I didn't realize they would be. And so that pulled me into you know, what has really been my whole career of looking at kind of many, many perspectives on that era of the past, not just sort of what European colonizers had to say about it.
What were they saying? What were the French and Spanish saying about the Osage and the Quapaws? And how were the Quapaws and the Osage's voices represented, you know, right, in here? And how did you deal with that in your work?
Right, right. So mostly they were saying, because these are in letters to their superiors, I really need more soldiers, I really need more goods, and sort of realizing, I think those men, those officers who'd been sent to Arkansas realized they needed to pay rent, basically, to the Quapaws for putting, and we think of forts as these, like, the European military comes in and has a bunch of soldiers and forces a fort onto native land, which, I mean, that is absolutely what happened sometimes. But in this place that was so far from the centers of European power, when they got there, they basically had to pay rent to the Quapaws. The Quapaws were, sure, you can put a fort here, but you have to pay us to put it there. And you have to keep bringing in European goods that we're interested in to pay us and to trade with us and be useful to us. Otherwise, you can't have a fort here. We won't let you unless you're useful. And so the French and later the Spanish, when it became part of Spanish Louisiana, did what the Quapaws and what the Osage told them to do. And then they had to explain to their superiors in these letters why they were having to do that. So they talk a lot about Native power. And they also, you know, there is, you know, I think when we read these letters, of course, they are written by European colonizers with their own perspectives. Mm-hmm. And when they report what a Quapaw leader says when he comes in and gives a speech, you know, it's through translation. There was an interpreter there who first had to interpret it into French or Spanish. And then it gets written down. And there are lots of places in which that real native voice is filtered and you know, changed and not represented exactly accurately. But because there are so many, like over and over, native leaders came in to see these officials and said the same things over and over, and other ones would come and give their take on it. It's a really rich archive in a place that you would expect no native voices, right? So they're filtered, they're not perfect, but they're really there, and they speak through the centuries.
Hmm. Growing up in Fayetteville, how did you know about the Osage and the Quapaws? Did you hear about them in grade school? Did you see signboards that then later on you reflected on and said, oh, maybe that's what that they were trying right. to say here. Yeah. That's what, how did you come upon that growing yeah. up in this place, just right here by
historical Oklahoma? Place.
Yeah, in this right. place that might be teeming with history.
Yes,
you, right. Did you have that sense of being in the center of this history that you're writing about?
I really didn't. No. And it was only, going back and so first starting to read these documents and think this was right here, right? This was Osage country. And it was sort of a border between the Quapaws and the Osage here, but they both used it as hunting grounds It had this rich history of them, but I didn't learn any of that when I was a kid. And only in retrospect did I think, oh, Osage Gap and the Quapaw Quarter in Little Rock. And, oh, right, those names are still here. And then I got to know actual Quapaw and Osage people today who, the reservations today are in northeastern Oklahoma, and they're not far away at all, right? But, I didn't hear about any of that growing up. I should say I had terrific history teachers at Fayetteville High, and I learned a lot of really great, important things. Not much about Native history.
Yeah. I wonder how you're going to attend college in California, which California and Texas are the producers of our nation's textbooks that the states adopt, right? So I wonder how going to California, which has a more left-leaning perspective in their textbooks, influenced the resources that you had access to even be exposed to these resources. Do you think that had anything to do with it?
I think so. I mean, I would say more of it was probably just going to history grad school and being around mm-hmm. people who do real good history and that forming the kind of historian I am. I worked for the state legislature for a few years in California, and maybe California wasn't quite as left-leaning then as it is now. There were plenty of debates at the time about all kinds of things, including about textbooks. There was a big sort of textbook controversies in the 80s and 90s too. So this isn't new, right? Yeah.
I was born in 92. So
you missed that round of it.
Oh, it feels new to me, but nothing is true. It's true. Nothing new under the sun, right?
That's right. That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. Back then it was people were really worried about multiculturalism in textbooks. Mm-hmm. So, Yeah.
Well, I love your textbooks. They are beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
the images in it are stunning. The color is amazing. I saw what influenced your choices of images, and why did you put so much emphasis on choosing very high quality images in your textbook?
Yeah. I mean, I think you all know, when you write, most of the time when a historian writes a book, we get to have a color picture on the cover and that is it. And all of our other beautiful possible images are in black and white in the middle of the mm-hmm. book, or there at all. And this is, as you say, this is the opposite of that.
Yeah.
You get to have all these beautiful big pictures. And mm-hmm. so I think, as in that kind of writer who does so much, having to put paintings in black and white, which don't end up looking that great. I just really emphasized color. I wanted as much color as possible. Mm-hmm. But also, you have to think about, is it a picture that you can tell what's even going on in it on the page. So a really elaborate cartoon, for example, might be hilarious and great to use in the classroom. But if students can't zoom in on it, it's just meaningless. So, and then now, as more and more students are using the ebook and more professors are assigning the ebook, we're able to play around with that even more. And so in the current ebook, there are some things there. Several of the pictures, there's a whole exercise on it where the student can zoom in on different parts and see different parts really well and learn a little bit in a footnote sort of way about different parts of the image. So we're starting to think about it that too, not just beautiful on the printed page, but then also are there some that are maybe a little richer and mm-hmm. having a student be able to look even closer at it in the email would also be useful. So we're sort of trying to balance those as we know there are students using both kinds of books.
Yeah, as a K-12 classroom teacher, I have always had to use these black and white images, and some of the ideas and the things that you want your students to analyze get lost in viewing translation just because you need that color
right.
to make details to pop,
yeah.
to give tone.
Right. And as an early Americanist, I worry sometimes that you know, students think the whole world was in black and white in the past.
Oh, that's
Always been
good.
in color.
Yes.
Yeah, but the black and white certainly, I think, adds to their sense of, oh, it's the extreme distance and it cannot be accessible.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, that is interesting. So this early America, are we even calling it America?
Well, it's, oh, we have so many crises over what to call it exactly. Although, you know, it's not early because, of course, Native Americans have been here for tens of thousands of years. So it's really, it's still very recent to talk about the 1600s.
What are some of the debates about what do we call this period of time before 1787 and that, you know, what before the Revolutionary War?
Exactly. So I grew, you know, I went to grad school. We called ourselves early Americanists, but of course then all the Latin Americanists say you can't claim all of America if all you study is what later becomes the United States. What else? Oh, also, my field has really changed in the last maybe 40 years or so from a really, really narrow focus, I think, on the 13 Atlantic coast colonies, and particularly English men within those colonies. To really broadening out not only the, you know, the kinds of people we talk about, you know, people from other parts of Europe, Native Americans, people from West Africa, that is all part of what becomes early America, whatever you want to call it, to also broadening out across the continent to make sure places like Arkansas and California are as much a part of what, you know, what we learn about, say, the 1700s as North Carolina is. That there's plenty of history going on in Arkansas. In the, you know, DeSoto walks through here and gives us a window into this, you know, changing world of Native America in the 1500s. And then, you know, through, you know, all kinds of, Arkansas history doesn't start with the Louisiana Purchase, right? For example.
Great. Wonderful. So, you know, would you be able to tell us then? So I imagine, given that we're in this politically charged atmosphere where learning history is, you know, is being taken up into these kind of legislative cases, did that factor into your decision as you're coming up with this new volume of and titled Give Me Liberty, you know, a textbook called Give Me Liberty and American History? How are these legislative cases about the teaching of history, and you know, what would you tell the parents who are concerned about, you know, what they're children are studying or encountering in these books?
Yeah, that's a great way to phrase that question. I think in some ways I kind of would like them to read the books and sit in on our classes, because we're not doing scary things. We're not, you know, we're not, say, historians don't, I mean, what historians are most interested in is how people understood the time that they were living in and why they made the decisions that they did. And so,
can you imagine that we were the lame people in schools? People thought we were nerds, and now all of a sudden we are the center of legislative issues. Like, how
we came up,
this important.
Haters love it. The underdogs on top.
Oh, how these tables have turned.
Nerds, the nerds were the great threat. Yeah. I mean, what we're interested, like, we, you know, we assign our students primary sources. We say, try to understand how this person saw themselves and how they acted in the world. And then we'll assign them a different primary source, right? And say, okay, this is a person who totally disagreed with that other person. Now try to understand that person. It's all about, I mean, something pretty close to empathy. Not that we, you know, agree with all the people in the past. We don't. We're totally different from all the people in the
emotional
past.
Intelligence, emotional understanding intelligence. The difference, building up this kind of a muscle of understanding, having debates. People are going to disagree with you.
You have to pair historical empathy with historical thinking skills.
Yes, exactly.
They can't happen separately.
Exactly. Put yourself in somebody's shoes, but based on real evidence. Yeah, not, we don't make this stuff up, but interpretations are individual. And students, yeah, as you say, can have different interpretations. And so in writing the textbook, we really try to be multi-perspectival to just like, here's somebody's perspective and here's somebody else's perspective and here's somebody else's perspective. And you, the student, you know, probably shouldn't agree with any of them because you live in the 21st century, right? But what you should do is try to understand what they did and why. And if, you know, at the end of the day, you think some of them, you know, did things that were bad, that's fine. You know, they, people do things that are bad, but as that should be something that students sort of can figure out as they read sort of the facts and of the past.
Well, so who has been like your audience? And when you were writing this book, who did you have in mind?
Yeah, so we really think of, you know, I think certainly high school history students, general APUSH history students, and then the sort of lower division, entry-level survey college students. So I teach the book in my 100 level class, and the half that I teach is, you know, US history to 1865, and then my colleague who teaches 1865 to the present also uses the second half of it. So, you know, sort of early college students, late high school students, and you know, students who can who already have had a, you know, K through 10 or so education with a lot of good history in it, but are ready to sort of move to the next level of understanding. And we have a lot of primary sources in there for them to sort of get their, you know,
you sure will do.
History skills with.
Yeah. Yes. And I feel like for myself, this is the textbook that my 10th graders could use, my ninth grader.
Good. I'm really glad you know that better than I do. So I'm really glad to hear that. Good.
I think it would be really engaging for them.
Good.
It would cause them to interact with the text with this idea of good trouble for themselves, you know, of their troubling the waters of their thought and preconceived learning and notions. Thanks. And so, like, I personally think it would be very engaging for the 9 through 12 context.
Oh, terrific. Good.
For sure. Because, and I, as looking through the chapters, what I see that you have these focus questions for each chapter, and they're really broad to whatever time period that you're talking through. And I love that in the textbook, you have at the top that question that chapter or that portion of the chapter is focusing on. And then what are the little green arrows that are on there?
Like terms. So you're right. We have a sort of banner across the top that has a question, but it changes over the course of the chapter. And then those green arrows are sort of more specific terms, like, oh, student, this is a term that you might want to like pay particular attention to.
That might be an ID on a test or something like that.
Right. This wise student will realize thing. That might be on the test. Right.
And so what I was realizing looking through it was that these green arrows are cueing to the students, like this is a potential answer to that focus question at the top.
Right.
Doesn't necessarily give them the answer, but it shows them this is the idea, and then it allows teachers to say, now explain this idea as it's embedded in the time period in the text.
Love terrific it. Reading of that. When we're doing it right, those should fit together. Yeah, exactly.
She teaches teaching, so it's a very interesting perspective. She's in the School of Education.
Okay.
She teaches curriculum and all that. Yeah. So it's very fascinating to see how she approaches the text. And I'm like looking at like, well, your argument is this.
Right.
You know, and she's honing down on like, you know, how are we cueing the things for students to learn, especially as she's teaching teachers who are going out into different classrooms. I find that extremely fascinating. But I was wondering, you know, are the chapters starting with the Atlantic world, the Chesapeake Bay, going, you know, the slave trade? Is this consensus? Are these chapters that you guys choose to put in this book, is this based on, what is it based on? Is why did you choose to do this or choose to start here as opposed to 1619.
Right, right, exactly. Right? Yeah.
Or in Virginia, or, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. You know, could start in Spanish Florida or whatever the case might be. How are you making these decisions to do the chapters? And can you tell me about a time you had to make a difficult mm-hmm. decision about, okay, we can't do this, we can't include this, but then we had to, you know, we have to exclude that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, one of the things that is completely invisible to students is that you can't write a textbook like this if there isn't a terrific set of historical monographs, right? Books mm-hmm. that historians have already written about all of these topics. So no textbook writer writes these things from scratch. Sometimes, you know, we'll look at the historical documents to sort of pull in a little more specifics, but we rely on the books that historians have already written. And so, the shape of the book reflects the historiography. So one of the changes in this edition, the seventh edition, reflects that changing historiography of early American history from just a narrow focus, as I said, on the 13 British colonies, to a broader sort of continental view of North America, combined with the Atlantic world. So
is that because of debates that historians are having as the Atlantic world became a new field, maybe rivaling early America, taking into consideration early America and being more inclusive of Africans and indigenous?
Exactly. And in fact, Atlantic world makes it much easier, provides much better context for understanding African-American history, right? And continental history, including the whole continent, provides much better context for understanding indigenous history. And in both ways, sort of geographically, they just broaden the lens from those Atlantic coast colonies from Massachusetts to Georgia and just say, okay, look, there's a whole world out here. And it is, obviously, 1619 Virginia is in there, but it is contextualized in, for example, that slavery and the slave trade are much older than that, right?
That's one of the big debates. That's one of the big pushback against Nicole mm-hmm. Hannah-Jones and her team, that you're talking about 1619, but slavery is existent in other parts of the Americas,
right.
in Spanish right. Florida and other places mm-hmm. before 1619. Mm-hmm. So maybe the 1619 start date, even though we understand that she's talking about, what would become... Virginia as the prominence it holds in the United States or whatever the case might be.
So that's understandable. But I think historians can bring that longer context. Let's see, white Virginians didn't invent slavery and didn't invent the slave trade, right? The Spanish and the Portuguese had been involved in it for a lot longer. The English get very involved in it, and
very late. They were latecomers to the game.
They're latecomers, which in no way excuses them. I mean, they are wholeheartedly involved in it. But as historians, we like the bigger story. And you asked about sort of things that have to be cut a little bit because, right, we add every time there's a new edition, we add things. And as my editor always tells me, and that means you have to cut that much stuff.
Cut so the darlings.
Exactly, right. And so there is a little bit less stuff about the English founders of Virginia and Massachusetts, because there are other people who need to be included in this too.
So what was you all's like mission or vision philosophies when making this textbook? What guided your choices? And then when you're releasing new editions, mm-hmm. what is guiding your choices of what to cut?
Right. That's much harder than what to add, right? So the theme of the book is freedom, right? Give me liberty and freedom. But it's always been a big view of freedom. And at it, the central question at the heart is, what did freedom mean for different people at different times? And so Eric Foner is obviously a great historian of the 19th century, and that's really the writing that he's done in the book on 19th century slavery and emancipation and reconstruction, takes, you know, freedom as its theme and looks at sort of different angles on freedom through all of that. And then the same is true for the early part, you know, the pre-19th century and the 20th century parts of the book as well. And then each time we do a new edition, we have a new, like we keep that big theme of freedom, but we have a new sort of angle on it. So with this seventh edition, our objective was to increase Native American history in there, but always keep it in sort of conversation with that big theme of freedom. So I think one of the things we really emphasize is that Native Americans have had a different view of freedom from other Americans. I'm not that they all have the same view of freedom either, but that there's particularly for Native Americans, part of freedom is sovereignty of their particular Native nation. So for the Quapaws, really? For example, Quapaw sovereignty, remaining a nation, has been and still is today an important part of how Quapaw people see freedom. And so we try to we've added some things throughout the book that really increase Native American coverage and particularly Native American views of freedom. And a lot of textbooks sort of drop Native Americans right about Indian removal or so in the early 19th century. We hear very little about Native Americans in the 20th century. And we try to really rectify that and show, okay, Native Americans are here today, right? So they could be also here in the 20th century.
They haven't left.
They haven't left. So there must be a story to tell in between. And, you know, we're talking earlier about history books. There have been lots and lots of historians writing on 20th century Native American history, you know, so smaller cuts of it, you know, what was going on with Native activism in various ways, or sort of
red power.
Exactly. Right. So we're able to pull from historians who have been working on those things and put them, make sure Native Americans are covered in, you know, in the 20th century and shown to be, you know, part of the 20th century in the way that all Americans are, but in particular, you know, in particular ways, a lot of which have to do with the continuing sovereignty of Native nations, even under the United States in the 20th century.
Stay tuned for more on discipline after this commercial break.
I'm Denisha Simpson.
And I'm Joy McGowan.
And we are the co-host to the Resilient Black Women podcast. Our podcast is all about demystifying mental health for Black women, women of color, and women everywhere.
You can learn more about our work with our nonprofit and our podcast by visiting resilientblackwomen.org.
You can also listen to our podcast at KUAF.com or subscribe to our podcast on any streaming platform.
Welcome back.
I was just going to say, I love that, you know, this idea of freedom. And then you have the book's name being Give Me Liberty, you know, Patrick Henry's favorite, give me liberty or give me death, right? And yet
we do sort of start in Virginia.
And yet he dealt with the contradiction of give me liberty, give me death, but also being a slave owning, holding individual.
Right.
And yet all folks, as they have been invited to this unique American fabric of life, have been trying to grapple with this idea of freedom, with the contradictions of American society and culture and government as it's produced. So I feel like the title is well to analyze how America has historically and is still grappling with this idea of what liberty and liberation and freedom means for each of us as, you know, cultural actors.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it's got an exclamation point at the end of it. It's a demand for liberty.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that applies to all kinds of situations throughout American history, that sort of arguing over what freedom means, what liberty means, who should get it, and how, you know, all kind, men and women of all kinds, right? And changing over time.
Yeah,
it's a theme that works in every era. Maybe sadly, like it'd be nice to like, okay, we settle freedom and everybody's free. Fine. Yes, but it keeps not quite being true.
We got bigger problems. It's been the biggest.
Yeah, it really has. But I feel like, you know, going back to our conversation about parents who might be worried. It's just a, you know, it's a conversation. It's a, we're not indoctrinating students. We're teaching them skills and giving them some facts and you know, helping them to help make up their own minds and become the kind of people and think about freedom in their own lives as they, you know, as best they can.
So this is, as you mentioned that, you know, you all have expanded, you know, the meaning of American history and I, in my opinion, as we said earlier about the legislative issue, much of the issues that we face, I think, is because the powers that be think of history as a zero-sum game. Stories being told, who owns the story, right? So if whiteness is not centered in the history, then, you know, some people perceive that as, you know, America is losing its way, you know? The inclusivity is watering down the history. It's no longer authentic, you know?
Right. It's terrible. Yeah, there is so much to be proud of in the way that people have fought for liberty and expanded liberty. That idea that things are watered down when it's just getting richer and better.
I often ask my students, you know, with all the textbook that we've probably seen written on the founding fathers at Washington and Jefferson and all of them that could probably build the whole University of Arkansas just by using the books, the amount that has been published. And I'm just like, well, don't you guys want to know what poor white women think? They were there.
They had thoughts in their
brains.
Exactly, right. And many of them supported the American Revolution and boycotted tea and did all kinds of things that would have made, you know, winning the revolution. Like, you can't, the revolution is a civil war, right? You can't win a civil war without women, without women's participation. Right. It happens in their houses, in their towns, and on their farms.
Right. Sewing uniforms and doing all kinds of things, you know.
Right.
But
right.
It's because, you know, so much of, you know, this history, you know, tell us about how this kind of a history and storytelling, you know, these decisions that you ultimately have to be to make, how it's connected to the idea of power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
How's that connected to the idea of power and who gets to have a voice and have a say and be included.
Yeah, right. And, you know, you're just talking about the American Revolution. There's definitely Jefferson and Washington are in this book, absolutely. And they're arguing about power and they're worried about the power of the king. And the conversation about power, it should be no surprise that then people with less power than Jefferson and Washington also were talking about power, and that there are enslaved men who join up with both the Continental Army and the British Army who wear sashes that say liberty, and they mean enslaved people
something different
when they wear liberty, even if they're fighting in the Continental Army. That I was just telling my students the other day that if you look at the roles of the men who enlisted in the Continental Army from Connecticut, for example, you can find in those roles people, men who were enslaved at the time that they enlisted and hoping to get their freedom for enlisting. So they serve in the Continental Army. They're at the major battles of the American Revolution. And quite a few of them, more than a dozen of them, when they wrote down their name, wrote down their last name as either Liberty, Freedom, or Freeman. And you say, okay, when at the moment when they enlist and they're going to fight in the American Revolution, they're also claiming something about their own freedom with the name that they choose.
Probably stamping it right at that their moment. Names.
Exactly.
So they're by doing that, they're expanding. I mean, for America to be claiming, right? That would be something to be proud of, for America to be claiming itself as the land of liberty, for the least among you to be saying, look, you know, freedom mean all these things. And you also said that all men are created equal and this should be universal, you know, and you should be, that's even more claim for America to be looked like. For our very foundation, we had all these people who were, you know, articulating the importance of freedom and liberty for us.
Mm-hmm. For us, it's a name. For them, it was a statement. You know, it deserved a period.
An exclamation point.
Period. Okay. No further discussion.
That's all right. Yeah. That's a, and that's a great story. And that's an American story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I love your, you said that, you know, we have to look at this as a richer story. Mm-hmm. You know, like when we see each other in the elevator or at school or the coffee shop, you know, with being equipped with the knowledge of the past, the full truth of all those who have been and are living now through us, you know, it is an honor to stand in this place, to be in a space that historically and traditionally we have been excluded and wanting to divide. And so I love that idea of the richness, and that's what I feel that it does, you know, because the power of story is the sharing of power. It is understanding that power happens at every level in society and every contribution. And you can determine power, not by who has the loudest voice, but what fruits are produced from what you participate in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So don't let me preach.
No. It's not scary. It shouldn't scare
me. It's loving to me. It's loving.
Yeah.
So why, of all the textbooks that people can choose, textbook Texas and California and their production of textbooks, have you tried to get this textbook to be adopted by the states? I vote for it, but have you tried that?
Yeah, so I leave that mostly to the Norton sales people who are very good at it, but we are, at the community college and college level, we're in every state, I think. Actually, it's taught in a lot of community colleges in Texas. I hope it will continue to be. I like to think it should be, you know, not just that I think it should, obviously I think it should be, but also that it should be something that I think it is something that if textbook committees in Texas and places like that read, they should be like, okay, wait, this isn't nearly as bad as I thought it would be.
Yeah, and it reads easy, you know, like, cause I'm trying to salvage transform the soul of America's public schools. Okay. That's what I'm trying to do.
Yeah. I would love to see it in more high schools.
Why should this textbook be the people's choice though?
Let's see. I think I would go back to that sort of that multi-perspectival view on freedom, that it helps to teach how different people have seen freedom over time. And as you say, teaches it in a way that's pretty easy to read, that it has the sort of depth behind it of real history and really what historians are doing these days. But I'd like to think that it's, you know, it's written in a way that that anybody could read, and certainly high school students could get a lot out of.
Period, Pooh.
And it has pretty pictures.
Gorgeous. And I see myself so much in it.
Good, you know, good.
Full of color, so often. And I'm like, look at us.
Good. Wow.
Told you we was here.
Yeah, that makes me so happy.
As we're winding down here, Dr. Duvall, just for our audience, what do you think what purpose does learning history serve?
I should ask both of you that question instead. Maybe I'll answer it short and give you all time to answer it too. It helps at the end of the day, it helps us understand ourselves. It the world that we live in, the people that we see every day, but then also just ourselves. Like, how did I get here? What sorts of human decisions along the way made this place that we call home? I always say history also teaches us humility. I mean, it can teach us bravery and how people can change the world, but it also can show how people's decisions make really terrible things happen. And so being careful about, we were talking about power earlier, being careful about using power, you know, whether it's, you know, in a small scale, you know, at home, at school, or to people who have a lot of power in our society, being careful with it. You really can affect people's lives. And people have accidentally, sometimes on purpose, done things in the world that are really, really bad for other people. And sometimes they've done things that are really great and good for people too.
And how we are all like, we can't escape that, right? Like,
right.
I've been given some degree of power, and I have been guilty of using it as a form of violence in some cases.
Yeah.
You know? So being aware of that in my history is like, okay, check myself. Who am I being a mirror of right now?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
For the world.
That's right. That's right.
It seems then if we can then develop that kind of understanding from history, who we are, our place, how did this come to be, other people who might not be like us, right? And how they came to be, the kinds of things that help to shape their life's trajectory, you know, then ultimately it's helping us to be better custodians of the spaces that we inhabit and ultimately better citizens of
right.
the world.
That's right. Well, yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. Yeah. Better citizens of the better people in our communities, better citizens of the world.
Yes, absolutely.
And for me, it's also a battle plan. It's an agenda. And I say battle plan agenda because like we're still grappling with the contradictions of freedom that exists for all of us. And so with me having some nomenclature by knowing my history of what I'm experiencing day to day that may impact my emotions or circumstance, I'm able to, again, like you said, better equip myself with knowledge of my truth and the truth of others and how I can exist in a more peaceful and joyful way without having all of this this intergenerational trauma respond to my environment.
Yeah.
I'm battling the flesh, not other people.
Dr. Dudwal, you probably should know, as our audience will learn as well, that we had Elena Roberts on earlier this week.
Ah, wonderful.
Yes.
That's terrific. Awesome.
Go so you guys are in a conversations with one another as Native American historians, you know, and also dealing with those kinds of intersections as well.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a big fan of hers.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we discussed a number of different things, too. We talked about the kinds of conflicts that exist between Black people and Indigenous people and, you know, in current day, in our current society today that we'd like to get your take on as we're trying to build coalitions, you know, how we can do that, especially when we're thinking about repair, right? Or reparative movements, right?
Yeah.
I asked her about, you know, Black people who are on Indigenous territory, right? Are they settlers? Are they colonizers? In the way that we think about the white settlers.
I got my wig again. Let me fix it.
And, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on that in terms of, you know, the scholarship and all that.
Right, right. I think the kind of scholarship that Elena Roberts is doing is so important for exactly this kind of goal. I mean, both goals, you know, really understanding the past on its own terms, but also using it to understand the present. Because, of course, it's not the same, right? The histories of different people and why they ended up in the places that they did are not coming from the same place. But dealing with all of that today and sort of balancing Native nation sovereignty and their right to decide who are citizens of their nation with the fact that they need to admit more people to their citizenship than they have. Like, it is not something for an outsider like me to say a Native nation should do, but the kind of scholarship that Elena Roberts is doing, I think will persuade and is persuading an awful lot of citizens of Native nations, if not always their leaders, that it's time to change things. It's time to recognize the, you know, the history of slavery among many Native nations, not even just the most high profile ones.
I had no clue.
I mean, the numbers of enslaved people who were on the Trail of Tears and that sort of
going through Arkansas.
Right through Arkansas. Exactly. I think that just a little sunlight on that past will make a lot of people think differently, including a lot of people in Native nations who need to sort of just the way all of us are doing about the United States, consider things that not only things that happened to them, but also things that they did to other people that were not, things they're proud of today.
And I want to couch the significance by telling you the story that I heard growing up.
Yeah, please.
Which was that, as America continued to encroach upon Native lands and push them west, that, essentially Native tribes were a safe haven for Black folks. Like, we can go there and experience some freedoms, and that they would accept us in some rights. And so to have that challenge of perspective, like, no, we were slaves there with them too. So like it's very,
but there were some collaborations.
I'm sure there was. And I know there was some collaboration, and we have evidence of that, but that's not ever, that is the only story that I hear, is the collaboration, but not ever the story of
slavery,
So again, it's that the facts with the truth.
Yeah,
it's a fact that we collaborated, but is it the whole truth? Not exactly from what I was taught.
Right. That's right. And, as historians, all three of us know that history is almost always more complicated than we think at first. So like the history of the Seminoles is very, very different from the history of the Cherokees as far as slavery and the incorporation on equal terms of formerly enslaved people that the Seminoles did.
Yeah, we discussed that, like the Big Five versus the other, I hate to say others because I hate that word.
I know, it's really not right.
what word am I looking for? Versus, anyway, the big. I'm a prey on that one. Find that.
But you're suggesting that the Seminoles, because we know about the Black Seminoles, we know that, for instance, Fort Mosey, St. Augustine.
Right.
The ways in which they collaborated with Black people trying to get to freedom down in Florida, the kind of maronage that they, engaged in with indigenous people, African and indigenous people.
Yeah.
And they're different. Yeah.
Right. And sort of Black people are part of the forming of the Seminoles, like from the beginning. Like, the Seminoles are a new tribe that comes out of many different indigenous nations, but also mostly former enslaved or their descendants of enslaved people. So it's just a dramatically different history for the Seminoles. But lots to talk about there too.
Can you give us a little preview of what the University of Arkansas students and scholars and the broader community can expect to hear in your upcoming lecture?
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, so I'll be talking about, I'll be talking from my book that's coming out in April called Native Nations, A Millennium in North America. And I'll be talking about toward the beginning of the book in the 1300s or so, so before Europeans and Africans come to the Americas, about transitions that Native Americans made from very large cities like Cahokia and other Mississippian cities to a sort of more egalitarian politics, economics, culture that they really created in response to a cooling climate, the climate change as the world moved from the medieval warm period to the Little Ice Age. And then and lots of history that I think most people won't have heard about at all. So we'll start with cities, and then we'll talk about what came later. And then the very end, sort of Europeans who come and think that Native Americans are primitive, think that they've never had cities, and don't realize that they've actually established these extremely sophisticated systems of living more sustainably.
Oh, wow. So that means you're integrated urban and climate change, and we have to send you to DC.
I have some ideas.
our history representative.
We have to get you to DC, get you to see the government.
Yeah,
I look forward to it.
Historians.
Yes. One last question about the textbook.
Yes. Before we go.
So you have the brief version and then the full version. What right. would you call it?
Yeah, full. Yeah, that's exactly right. The full.
But
yeah.
but what when people are purchasing these texts,
yeah,
and they're making a decision between the brief and the full version, yeah. what are they what are they gaining, or what is different between the two books?
Yeah, so the full version has more pictures, and it has a little bit more text, but so we write the full version, and then we reduce it some, just cutting some things, cutting some explanations, but also cutting the number of pictures, to get it into that smaller and more affordable version. So it's sort of designed to be more affordable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm endorsing this textbook. Teachers, students, parents, community members, go check it out. I like it. I'm sure there are others. I haven't seen all the textbooks, so take my opinion with a grain of salt. But I really like it. As you can see, I'm really energized by it. And I think your students, your community members, your schools would be too. So whether you need the brief or the full thing, you can get either or.
Good. And if anybody needs a sample copy, they can reach me. They can email me directly at my UNC email address, which is easy to find online.
That's gracious of you.
Amazing. I think that's a good note for us to end on. This has been another wonderful episode of Undisciplined. Dr. Duvall helped us to explore the various areas of American history and how that is kind of brought to us through textbook. Mm-hmm. Please stay tuned. She will be with us here at the University of Arkansas mm-hmm. this upcoming week here in a lecture on Tuesday here in Old Main. So thank you so much, Dr. Duvall. We look forward to your lecture and to seeing you and meeting you in person. Welcome you back to your hometown. And to talk, have further conversations about this fascinating area of history that you're studying and your new project.
Thank you so much. I could do this all the time. This is just
wonderful.
Thank you
so very much.
Thank you for listening to another riveting episode of Undisciplined. This episode was hosted by Karee Banton and Carnesia Connor. It was produced by Leah Grant. Undisciplined is a collaboration between the African American Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and KUAF. It is available every other Wednesday at KUAF, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Follow the African and African American Studies Program and the Undisciplined Podcast on Instagram at @UARK_AAST or visit KUAF.com to listen to all episodes.
If you like today's episode, please subscribe to our podcast on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts and rate us.